we had a long memorial service for the three colleagues, Minister Fabiaci, former Minister Shikleka, and colleague Nyanda, Florence Nyanda. So we had the memorial service this morning. I was trying to wait for the members, but the problem is that we can't wait. I have not received any apology. So I think that we should start.
Chairperson, just a verbal apology for Marius, member Honorable Swart.
Thank you. We do know that Honorable Swart is not well. We know that he took ill yesterday, just before the meeting. Honorable Lili is also not well. There's an apology from Kulisi, Honorable Kulisi.
Yeah,
but the only apologies that we have. Our committee is thin, but now if one of us is not there, it becomes a thinner. Let me welcome the Treasury. I welcome TG, I nearly said honorable. Welcome and thank you for coming. This meeting was supposed to have taken place yesterday, but it did not take place yesterday because each of you were not here. And there was no accounting officer from National Treasury yesterday. And the members did not take kindly to that because there was no apology, there was nothing for the PG. So, members, the feeling was that we are expecting the accounting officer to account. In the event that he is not able to do so, but to send us, to inform us that he or she was not able to do so. And that didn't happen yesterday. The feeling, PG, is that there is a tendency to treat committees differently. Other committees become more important than the others. Now, the feeling of the members is that that should not be allowed to make other committees more important than the others. Our understanding is that committees are the same, they are equal, and therefore we would expect the accounting officer to treat these committees in that way. We do appreciate the responsibility on your shoulder. But the issue is that the committee needs to be informed upfront. Unfortunately, now today, those members who were feeling strongly, including myself, I haven't got a report from them. They could be running late for one reason or another. But I don't think that we should wait, because sooner or later, I mean, there are also extended public committees that are running. Honored Mashiro is a whip. My apologies. Honored Mashiro is a whip. He could be deployed, but he has not informed us. Excuse me? I think she said you or show you some best call from me at 12:13:50. From her, she not duty, she was yesterday duty, but I think there is duty. I'm not certain about the mission. Well, we don't know. But be that as it may, we really don't need a quorum. We need to continue. National Travis here, so we can continue. So may I invite National Travis to address us? So in fact, before I just say that one of members, we invited National Travis for the application. Well, we do understand that the process is halfway, but at the end of the day, this committee will be required to recommend to the House the passing of the appropriation bill. So I would have expected that all of us were here, so that we could understand exactly what the bill is all about. But we have agreed that we will continue without colleagues. So over to you, teacher.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, Mr. Sokon, and the rest of the members. It's unfortunate that the other members who were probably who share the same concern that we have about my not being here yesterday without an apology, I'm not here, but at least you would, I'm sure you would tell them, or the other members would tell them that I am now tendering my sincere apology that I didn't come, in fact, in particular for the fact that you didn't get a formal communication about my inability to come yesterday. That shouldn't happen, and we'll try and make sure that it doesn't happen again. Of course, I want to say, Chair, that I also appreciate the fact that you indicate appreciation for the amount of work that one in a position like I'm in has got to do, and the inability to be in a couple of places or more than one place at the same time, and sort of having to juggle. And that said, let me just then get straight into the presentation, which I'll be ably assisted in going through by Matthew Simmons to my left, and Rachel to my right. Certainly, when it comes to questions, all three of us will be very busy this afternoon. This 2012 appropriation bill, as members would know, was tabled alongside the budget, as is required by our law in February. It is a bill that provides for the appropriation of money from the National Revenue Fund, as our constitution requires that an act of parliament should provide for the appropriation of all monies that are in the revenue fund. except for those that are excluded by some relevant legislation. Of course, that would include breaking by direct charging. Of course, between the 1st of April until the time that this bill is passed by Parliament, some spending is already taking place. That is provided for in our constitution, and of course the in the PFMA, and usually there will be a provision also to that effect in the division of revenue pay, so that the spending that takes place between now and the time the bill gets passed is authorized in terms of that. But of course there is a limit on the amount of expenditure that can be incurred without this appropriation bill becoming an act of Parliament. It's about, 45% of last year's aggregate expenditure, and with the possibility of a further 10% after July, and beyond that, then government, and I would say all institutions that get their funding from the National Revenue Fund would experience difficulties. Hence, it becomes important that in time and a bill like this should be processed to the system until we end. And at this point, I shall invite Matthew to just continue with the presentation.
Thank you, TG. Good afternoon to you, Chair, and the members of the committee. From that introduction, I think that we can just run quite quickly through the structure of the bill, something I'm sure that we're all quite comfortable with. But the bill is broadly divided into votes, and each vote is divided into programs. The way in which the information is laid out in the tables in particular is a very broad economic classification, starting with current payments, which is further broken down into compensation of employees, goods and services, and other, and their transfers and subsidies, payment for capital assets, and payments for financial assets. You'll note that certain appropriations or allocations are marked with an asterisk that denotes that those allocations refer to a specifically and exclusively appropriated amount, and that generally is conditional grants that are covered by that particular aspect. To get into the appropriation bill that's in front of you today, or in this period, the 2012 budget really supports government's objective of accelerating the pace of economic expansion and job creation, and ensuring that the benefits of growth are shared more equitably and that the quality of service delivery is improved. That's the broad policy thrust of this budget, and the allocations before you are intended to support that insofar as it is possible. The issue of efficient and effective use of public resources is a very important issue. It's always an important issue, but certainly it appears as if it's an issue which we need to be considering much more keenly in the current period. Partly this is a result of very strong growth in government budgets that has taken place over the last 10 years, and perceptions and certainly quite a bit of evidence that suggests that this has led to some kind of laxity or inefficient use of public funds. Giving some more meaning to that quite broad policy statement, the issue of infrastructure development, job creation, support to the competitiveness of the economy, and local government service delivery were issues that stood out. The budget review and the budget speech, and I'm sure you've heard various different references to this from us over the time, is undertaking to give some effect to what we're calling a shift in composition of spending. The total level of spending is of course important from a macro and also a service delivery point of view, but the composition of that spending, the splits of that spending between consumption and capital spending is also an important economic and service delivery factor. We're of the view that consumption spending has grown very, very strongly over the last few years. While this may have been necessary, it has certain implications for the long-term sustainability of the fiscus, but it also has implications as to how the fiscus supports the economy and the broader evolution of achieving a more competitive and job-absorbing economic growth path. Provincial and national departments and public entities were asked to identify areas of inefficient and non-priority expenditure. We gave particular focus to shifting resources from administrative components and non-essential goods and services to the frontline services. This is, you know, we're dealing with over R1 trillion here, and as you know, identifying these kinds of nuances and details in the actual appropriations is a very substantial challenge. And this is again part of a process that is taking place beyond more than just the current budget phase. Overall, we were able to come up with around R80 billion of additional resources that we were able to provide for allocation or support for allocation over the 2012 medium-term expenditure period. Broadly speaking, this included baseline reductions of around R30 billion or baseline reprioritizations of around R30 billion. 9.2 billion of that was from a general, what we call a haircut to provincial and national departments and their entities. That haircut was the equivalent of about 0.4% of their total spending. And then about nearly R20 billion, which was identified through reprioritization effort in consultation with the departments. Just to give you some sense of how those additional resources, the R83 billion to be exact, was allocated between the various functions in the budget. We start up at the top right hand, that 23% refers to education, and then the colors as they're arranged move in a clockwise fashion. So the next one is the next item listed in the key, being economic support and environmental protection. And as you can see, certainly many of the priorities of government continuing to receive substantial additional resources, nearly a quarter of the additional resources going towards the broader human capital and skills environment, the economic support function getting nearly 20%, but also you can include in that economic infrastructure, so the broader kind of short-term growth enhancing interventions of government coming in at around 35-36% of the additional allocations, health and social protection being very important and very important areas of need, getting a substantial amount of money along with human settlements, defense, and then when you get up to the 11 o'clock side there, the 6% would be the general public services. Science and technology getting a substantial allocation relative to their baseline, but as a total, not a particularly large slice of the cake. Just looking at how the allocations have changed, and I think that there's some interesting challenges for us today, but also in making fiscal and expenditure policy going forward that this graph speaks to. Looking at how those allocations have been made, so we've managed to allocate them to the right areas of government, we feel, if you look at the previous slide, but looking at a different disaggregation in terms of what the money is actually being used for, we can see that at least in the short term, a very large share of it, nearly a third of it, is going towards improved conditions of service. Having an appropriately remunerated civil service is, of course, a very important, a crucial factor import to service delivery, but one has to question the extent to which these the continued large allocations of additional resources to conditions of service of public employees are feeding through into improved service delivery and enhanced developmental prospects for our people. So that's in 2012-13. We are budgeting that that allocation declines as a share of the total by 2014-15. It remains significant. Of course, if we end up with a considerably different outcome to the wage negotiation process that is currently taking place, we may find that, that we are going to have to allocate more than that indicated 15 or 16% to the cost of living adjustment. The other large items there, the dark grey, is what is being allocated strictly towards job creation. There are many things that we do that enhance job creation within the economy, but these are things that have kind of direct, where the purpose of the allocation is to enhance job creation. The light grey, the light grey towards the bottom, is infrastructure, and then the blue-ish area is local government and service delivery, and around the 11 o'clock area is the economic competitiveness support package. Just to look at each of the economic classification categories that the appropriation bill is presented in, and look at their averages over time, we can see the effects of the very considerable widening in the deficit that took place around 2008, and the deficit remains substantial, certainly at least for the short term. The uncomfortable, though necessary, impact of that is that debt service costs have grown very strongly. They've grown off a small base, so one doesn't need to overreact to this, but certainly it is a concern that we should be thinking about in terms of our long-term fiscal management and trajectory. We are expecting this strong moderation in compensation of employees, and certainly based on historical experience, this is going to be a difficult thing to achieve. However, without it, it is going to really challenge the resources that we have available to fund the other priority expenditure areas of government. In particular, the infrastructure and employment programs of government are going to be very difficult to achieve our ambitious targets if we're not able to moderate the growth in compensation more in line with growth in prices and costs within the economy. Transfers and subsidies relatively stable. Part of what we're struggling with is finding the resources to put into capital. There's been a very strong statement by the President around this. There are a number of very important initiatives. Certainly any understanding of economic progress for this country recognizes the importance of having the right social and economic infrastructure in place. But we are struggling a little to find the resources to considerably ramp up allocations in this area, partly because of the spending pressures that I've referred to in previous slides. Don't worry too much about financial assets. That's really just within one department. It's off a small base, and not, in my view at least, a particularly important part of the broad macro description of the budget. Just to elaborate a little on the infrastructure investment program and how we're looking to enhance that, where that enhancement takes place. As you all know, there's around $850 billion within the public sector that we expect to be spent. A very large part of that is to take place within the state-owned enterprises, and you can see that when you look at this table here, energy and transport being very large components of that table, and obviously with Transnet and Eskom being such large agencies, they take up a large part of that share. But from government side, on the local government side, in particular, water and sanitation is very important, but then also ensuring more effective delivery in the health, education, and community facilities is a very important challenge that we need to rise to. As a total of GDP, this number, if you look at the last row in that table, this number is not perhaps doing what we would like it to do. I think that certainly from government side, and we would like to see this accelerating a little faster. It's broadly around that 8% level and declining slightly towards the outer year. And there are a number of important challenges in getting this number higher. Partly it's about finding the resources to finance that, and you know, we can't just wish one had those resources. One has to find them either by borrowing from future consumption, or by reprioritizing existing resources from one form of expenditure towards capital. But then there are other issues around implementation capacity and planning capacity that are also very significant barriers to accelerating this number towards something we would be more comfortable with. A couple of the headline numbers, the 5 to 6 billion rand for next year towards compensation of employees, that's mainly that cost of living adjustment I was talking to earlier. Nearly 20 billion rand of the 80 billion rand is taken, 85 billion rand is taken from that over the next 3 years. Job creation function, 1.2 billion for next year. The community works program stands out there, as does the working for water and working on fire programs. The National Rural Youth Services Corps is also an important part of that, at 200 million rand for next year. The economic competitiveness and support allocations, 1.3 billion rand for the manufacturing competitiveness enhancement program for next year. That grows quite a bit, and we're envisaging total spending over the next 3 years of around 6 billion rand. Industrial development zones, also a substantial claim on that. Tertiary education getting 150 million rand for next year, but increasing quite considerably over the next 3 years to get us nearly a billion rand over the 3 years. Likewise with health, 150 million rand allocated towards NHI pilot projects, and that again ramping up over the next 3 years to strengthen that program, that project of government. Within the human settlements and community amenities, the substantial amounts, the regional bulk infrastructure, there's 1.3 billion rand allocated for next year for the repair of flood damaged infrastructure, 3.1 billion rand over the 3 years. There are some spending performance issues related to this allocation, something we're going to have to give some attention to as Treasury, but also as government, where a coordinated pattern is required in terms of making sure, much more coordinated pattern is required in terms of making sure that these monies are realistic and that they are effectively used. Eskom and the solar water geysers for households is a very important part of the economic infrastructure allocations. Economic services, general public services, defense, order and safety, a couple of smaller amounts, but also a similar pattern, relatively restrained for next year in terms of the total allocations, which tend to be quite substantial over the 3 years. We've included a number of detailed slides in the presentations that you've received. I'm not going to go through those, so I'll just pause at that point, Chair, if you don't mind, and we have the additional detail if any of it is required for further engagement. Thanks.
The details, perhaps, it might be useful to just for members just look, even if it's at one slide, to look, for instance, at the slide on the president, because they begin for each one of the votes. You can then see in the following slides that are attached as additional slides explanations of where the additional resources have gone and the breakdown and so on. This, Chair and Honourable Members, is in addition to having in the bill itself a small explanation on the aim for each vote. I'm stating something which I'm assuming you know, but and then you know, bit of detail on each one of the votes, so that at least the information on which you base your decision to approve, amend, or turn down the bill is sort of informed by these details.
Thank you very much, PC. Madam, welcome. In case of affirmative. Honored members, there is a presentation. I think that. Thank you, Chair. I think it's interesting, but I hope that those numbers on slide 7, you know, I think those colors are just colors, just to differentiate. There's no priority or anything about them. Am I right?
No, the colors don't mean anything, but I know that some people would prefer red to other colors.
I like blue because of my background as a teacher.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I turn to page 8. Well, this is double page. Page 8 and also page 10. On page 8, I don't know whether I missed it, but the position of the 29% and 27% other priorities. Can the Treasury just elaborate on that again? Exactly, you know, what are we talking about on those pieces of both of the pies for 12, 13, and 14, 15? And then, Chair, on page 10, you know, we talk about a very, very huge amount. The second bullet, 844 billion in public sector infrastructure expended over the next 3 years. Now, the question that always arises when one sees such huge figures is, you know, it's been budgeted for, it's been allocated, but the question at the end of the day is, do we have the capacity in the economy? Not necessarily skills, I'm talking about broadly capacity, infrastructure, transport, communication, you know, everything that you need in the economy and that you need, logistics that you need for the different departments to spend such a huge amount productively, not just spend for the sake of spending, but productively. Do we really have the capacity so that we can be sure that such a huge amount over the next 3 years will be spent productively? And what measures are in place, you know, to evaluate whether it has been done at the end of the day for the different departments that are involved in this process. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation, DG and team. I have quite a few questions. One of the first things that I was looking at, Chairperson, is National Treasury's response to questions raised by us, and their response was on 28th of February 2012. I just picked this up from my files there. And I think one of the first issues we raised with National Treasury was a question of transfers. to municipalities and provinces, and the monitoring of this money, the spend on this. And I'd just like to know from Treasury, I mean, have they improved their methodology in terms of monitoring the spend of grant funding to municipalities and to provincial governments? And I'm asking this, Chairperson, on the basis of a question that I sent to Treasury early on this year, and I haven't received a response. Last year, in November, with regard to a particular municipality. It was a copy of a letter that was sent to the Minister for COPTA regarding a particular municipality, because I received lots of complaints about the way they spend this infrastructure grant. And the municipality in question is Mdoni, U-M-D-O-N-I, which received about 198 million rand, I think, a few years ago. But when one looks at value for money, the complaint from the residents in that area suggests that there was no value for money. A road which would have cost maybe 3 million, 4 million, eventually 40 million was spent. So to what extent is there an intensive look at whether there's value for money, particularly on conditional grants? And in this particular case, I'd still like to be favored with a response, because I asked for a forensic audit of this conditional grant in that particular municipality. And to date, I haven't received any response. So that's the one question about transfers. The second general question that I'd like to ask, Chairperson, is the impact of the Money Bills Amendment Act, as far as Treasury is concerned. We know for many, many years there was no act in place. It was not promulgated by Treasury or the Minister of Finance until a few years ago. And it was very pleasing to note yesterday or the day before, we received a statement to say that the Office of the Speaker has now engaged the services of a Professor Mohammed, let me call him Mohammed for all intents and purposes, but not for the record, from the DBSA, to look at the establishment of this office, Parliamentary Budget Office. I got it through an info alert. You know, I try and read all my emails even if it's 2 in the morning. But it was an info alert. I don't know if this committee has been informed, because this is something certainly that I would have raised very strongly in our budget debate. But I saw it on info alert, a message from the Speaker's office to say they've engaged the services of this DBSA person, and they give his curriculum vitae, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and that person has been charged with the responsibility of advising on the establishment of the Parliamentary Budget Office, liaising with our committee, finance committee, private sector, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe we need to get that. But I know for some time now, Treasury hasn't been... And maybe I can be corrected here, too supportive of this kind of oversight. Maybe I'm wrong in suggesting that. In the kind of oversight, because for all intents and purposes, as Parliament, I mean, we could either say yes or no to a budget. Now we've got the muscle to amend, to suggest amendments, but we don't have the capacity, and we must admit it. As members of Parliament, we don't have that capacity to interrogate the budget of the Department of Justice or whichever department, and to make suggestions. And this is where the Parliamentary Budget Office is going to come into play and assist us and provide us with that kind of support. So I just want to know what Treasury's view on, and how is Treasury going to assist this process so that we as members of Parliament can be empowered to also make amendments to particular amounts that you've allocated in your appropriation bill. And a case in point, Chairperson, is I was chatting with the Chairperson of Justice the other day, and he told me he had a discussion with you as well, Honorable London, where, I mean, he says Justice vote has been cut down by 500 or 600 million, and it's 600 million, and it's having a serious impact on the service levels in the Justice Department. Now, we can't say anything about it, because we don't have the capacity to go in with a fine-tooth comb and say why the Treasury has that kind of information. So I'm asking that view of Treasury on this. Then coupled to that, Chairperson, is last week we received NYGA, where they were complaining to us that their budget was cut. Now, I mean, they come to our committee, we are the oversight committee, they complain. But what can we do about it? All we can do, and we said we want to do, is to ask Treasury. We can take action. We must ask Treasury now. Please tell us, maybe you don't have the answer, what informed this kind of the cut? Because these young people came there making a plea, and not necessarily that we agree with them, but we need to be also taken on board. What informed the cut on the NYDA's vote reduction? Chairperson, another question is on the salaries. The negotiations are underway. And I know the minister said at some stage, I think 5%, 5.5% DG, if I'm not 5%. But with negotiations, we know it might go to 7, it might go to 8, there might be strikes, there might be all sorts of things happening. When that happens, where does that source of revenue come from? Do you start cutting other departments? Or is there a kitty somewhere where you can say, well, we think it might be 7% and let us have this contingency kind of thing? Because sometimes one gets, you think, oh, you fight for 3 months and there's strikes and people take to the streets and cause chaos, and then Treasury or government will come along and say, all right, we'll give you another 1% or 1.5%. I just like to know from our own, where does that resource come from? Is somebody else suffering because of that? I'm sure there are going to be other questions here, but the last question I'd like to ask is fiscal dumping and money is allocated to state-owned enterprises. I think in this committee we said at one stage that, we don't know the programs of the state-owned enterprises, the infrastructure programs. And would it not be helpful to Parliament that some of these major infrastructure programs are listed and the envisaged amount to be spent, so that as part of monitoring and evaluation, we can monitor these projects, because generally we're focusing on our 37 or 38 departments, but not on the transfers to these SOEs, which are carrying the bulk of the infrastructure spend. I'll just stop there.
I don't want to maybe on the latter side, Honorable Speaker. I don't want to answer for the speech, for National Treasurer. But I think with your last comment, I remember if you remember now, I'm sure if you can take answer to remember Minister saying from now on, I think from the next budget, he was saying we're going to list exactly what he's saying. But the truth is I will respond to that. But I remember him very well. Clearly saying that when he was taping. But also the other question I didn't understand very well, whether you were saying that National Treasury must assist us to implement the Money Bills Act when we do oversight over the National Treasury must assist us. I'm not sure whether you were saying that. No. I think they understood.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Chair, and also thanks for the breaking news of Mr. Singh about the budget office. I thought that this committee is part of this process. It looks to me we were not part of this process. But anyway, compensation of employees. I'm a little bit concerned if you look at slide 9, on page 9, or that's, I think page 9. If you look at the second 8.4% there. Now, that is, if you look on your left one, that's 6.73%. Now, what that constitutes as the growth in the composition debt service cost. You know, what constitutes the growth in the debt service? You know what I opt for? Because I think he also, the same also raised that. But I'm concerned about that, and because this is a ballooning of, is the money not coming from the compensation of the employees? I'm a little bit concerned about this because What is the value that we will get out of it at the end of the day when it comes to the projects and that kind? I have some other questions, but I think I'm covered by the questions that Dr. Van Dijk and Singh raised here. But I will in the next round talk.
Thanks. I want to try and find out from Treasury the concurrent functions within the provinces. National Department sets the policy for the country. Then we appropriate through division of revenue, appropriation, grants, etc. Has Treasury got anything in place that sees that the annual performance plans and the strategic plans of provincial departments speak to those of national departments? Or in the kind of independence that the legislatures have got to appropriate monies that are appropriated by a national to those legislatures, have they got total independence without regard to ensuring that their annual performance plans and strategic plans are speaking broadly to the national plan? Thanks.
You're raising that in the context of the outcome that the government wants to achieve. Yes. Okay. Nandan. That's all right. Now, if I let me just add something, some general questions, PG, that we normally ask, especially during when we do the in-year monitoring. You know, one is a question of the uniformity. I don't know if uniformity is the right word of or whether streamlining of budgeting. You find, for instance, that Department A has got 50% or 60% of the budget in Department A is in administration. Then in what you think that is supposed to be the core, what you call the responsibilities of the department, smaller figure. Now, and when you interrogate private administration, you find that there are all kinds of issues that we thought that don't really belong there. But where is budget? We do not know. But I mean, we think that there is something not normal about this. We don't know if National Treasury has noticed it, and if it has noticed, what you think about it. I also want to add to the question that I think Honorable Dr. Van Beek and maybe Honorable Harold Long raised around this infrastructure. I think that we appreciate this question of the infrastructure. But the challenge that we have is that there are some of the resources don't come directly from fiscal, and whilst others do. Now, we would like to, and this infrastructure amount, for instance, spending over MTF is announced by the Minister of Finance. Like in page 10, for instance, going to the 844.5 billion by year. See that amount? I think you said, Dr. Van Dijk, all coming from fiscal. If not, how do we do oversight over it?
and I know that we are trying to come up with our own oversight program. Arutner raising this question that how do we do it? How do we ensure that that money is spent? You know, how do we monitor it? But part of that is the Divna's revenue. I like the Divna's revenue. It says that it seems to me that it's focusing on the transfers to provinces that under national department, because it says any department that intends implementing infrastructure in the following financial year must indicate their time frame by when it must indicate what by that time. Now come the financial year, people can't spend. The delays, tenders, all those kind of things, and people seem to be planning when they were supposed to be doing it. Now, the role of National Treasury in monitoring that clause, which I think that is a good clause in the Division of Revenue, is implemented across. I mean, if you look at the third quarter report, I'm sure you have seen the third quarter report. Some infrastructure implementing departments are at 50%. And to your surprise, DG come 31st of March, 100% they've spent. From 50% in 9 months, in 3 months' time, they spend the other 50%. Clearly, that money hasn't gone to actual spending. And I think that is something that as a committee would like to look at those departments to say, well, show us where did you spend this money between this period. But my question is mainly around the planning, the role of Treasury around the planning of this infrastructure, so that we don't experience this thing. The other one related to that, there are these infrastructure, big infrastructure projects, you know. But within that, there are others. I think it's on slide 11. Can you put in slide 11? Those ones, small ones, some of them, they include EPWP and other. I don't know what the departments do. They don't spend those on. You find that those monies are not spent in the department. Instead, they are shifted to somewhere else. Now, they defeat the whole purpose of creating jobs. I mean, you can look at them. We monitor them. Our responsibility to monitor this thing, and we see that this thing is happening. It happens with many of these departments. Now, well, the appropriation. We have changed the wording now on clause 5. In the other years, it normally says further reserve the right to approve. But this year, I think it's mostly what you call approved decision. That's about savings, notwithstanding section 43, 4, blah, blah, blah. But the issue is that, you know, in those small, what you call a in those small programs in the department, those programs, your community work program, working for water, working on fire programs, I think I've seen it in the trade and industry sector, they don't spend. Zero spending, whether it's in energy, they take those money and put them somewhere else, not spending altogether. Now,
We have not, what to call it, been consulted, but no, there will be shifting of resources here. I don't know if National Treasury has been consulted and agreed to it, but now, with those kind of committee work, for example, say the committee work for committee work program will create about 250,000 job opportunities. But if you shift them, it means that those people who are supposed to benefit there are not going to benefit because it has been shifted. And then I would like you to comment on, like I said, around the Section 5 of the deal. Now, this is not crafted in the same way it's normally crafted, but Section, I think it's 13 or 14 of the Division of Revenue, it says I'm trying to get my copy of the Division of Revenue. I think it's Section 13, which says that when the shifting of resources are made, Parliament will be consulted. And now, I just want to see if there's no contracting shift between that clause. I'll bring it to the picture, don't worry. You remember it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's 14, on 14 of the Division of Revenue. And this one, if there are no contracting shifts, that one requires, that one says Parliament will be consulted here. There's nothing about consulting Parliament. Yeah. Okay. Any further comments? One of my people, welcome. No comment? You want to comment?
I'm sorry I did not share the presentation, but I would like clarity that when we are seated in the hearings and we hear a department saying they have already asked for a rollover, and then we ask ourselves whether it goes along with this new appropriation bill, where does it fall? If they say they've already asked for a rollover and we know that we have this bill in front of us, because we think as a department that works with this department, like we can talk about libraries. They've never spent their appropriated money, those grants. But what happened, because we know that there are no libraries, and then the money is still here as it is, never worked. What does the Treasury do about those departments that get grants, like this is a conditional grant, the one for the library is a grant, I don't know what type of a grant, but you see it being reflected, even the way they don't spend it is used on compensation of employees when for the real job is not being used, but it's being there. Can the department be called and be asked or some measures be taken, because that money was allocated for a specific purpose and is never used. And we would also like to know, as you say, about this rollovers or system of funds, because those funds were asked for a specific purpose. Can the Treasury pick it up and deal? I wasn't there, I don't know whether it was asked, and deal appropriately with the department that needs the rollover, hospital revitalization, and all those people who ask for rollovers, and they know that they'll bypass us and tell us that no, that is already being done. Can something be done about it with our consultation? Thank you.
Over to you, PG. No, but I think that really question that Harold Mashiko is saying. What we are saying, we know that the departments may not be prepared in terms of budgeting. There might be issues, new dynamics coming up during the year that require them to shift the, what you call it, the resources. But I think it's, I think it's just adding on the question that I was raising earlier.
Thank you, PG. As I indicated, I'm going to be assisted quite a lot by my colleagues who are, in some cases, more familiar with some of these details than I am, by the way. But let me just take a few questions. Starting closer to the end with the Section 5 and the difference, or whether there's a tension between Section 5 and the section you referred to in the Division of Revenue Bill. The two of them deal, Chair, they sound related, but they deal with very different things. Section 5 in the Appropriation Bill is aimed at facilitating some flexibility. It's kind of a response to genuine complaints from departments. For example, sometimes departments, which is what Section 5 proposes to allow now, they may see that they are not spending, say, on a particular program fast enough. The planning, the procurement, and all of that may have taken long, and then you get close to the end of the year. Then they face the reality that until such time that, and it's related to the rollover question, by the way, until such time that the adjustment appropriation gets tabled, which may approve the rollovers, they will not know if they will have the money to continue the program. So what this allows now is that to the extent that sometimes there may be a legitimate agency, say of government or institution that they are related to, which can still continue to do the same thing that the money was appropriated for, then they can transfer the money to that agency. Right? That's the one thing that Section 5 deals with. Now, and there shouldn't be a problem with that, where legitimately a department has got a program, there have been delays, they want to continue, and they transfer to an institution, but it's not fiscal dumping, but it's more about just making sure that the program doesn't get disrupted. But the second bit is more about some flexibility, again, internally within a vote, which allows the moving of funds from capital within limits, but it also disqualifies movement to compensation of employees, because that would work against the same objective that the presentation has talked to of changing the composition of expenditure. So you can't allow people to take money away for that. But for any other purpose that's genuine, good, acceptable, it would be okay. The Division of Revenue Act provision, on the other hand, is intended to deal with moving funds between, for an example, provinces. You table one Division of Revenue Bill, you set the allocation, KZN is going to get, let's say, 20% of the hospital revitalization grant, Eastern Cape 16%. After 6 months into the year, you realize that the pace in KZN is too slow, the pace in Eastern Cape is faster. There is going to be underspending in KZN. If Eastern Cape doesn't get more money or slow down the expenditure, they will overspend. Then you facilitate the shifting. Parliament had felt, that's my understanding, that perhaps we're giving too much power to ourselves if we say we should do that movement without coming to Parliament. And interestingly, by the way, I seem to recall this, and I don't think it was in a dream. Once we had introduced that change, then the question was, will it work fast enough? But we said, look, I mean, we didn't have it previously. There was an objection to it. We have responded now. We're putting the provision to say Parliament will be consulted. It might take longer, but it's worth trying. So that's what it was dealing with. The Honorable Mashiko was asking about connection between rollovers and the current year's allocation, which I might just, and then this is the last one I'll talk to. Or perhaps I'll talk to the concurrent functions thing and then leave the rest to my colleagues. The rollovers occur because in 1 year, let's say 2012-13, what year were we in? Or 2011-12, a department, let's say for argument's sake, only spends 60% of its allocation. And then the next year's budget gets tabled. The department knows it understands in the previous year. It usually works reasonably well, by the way, with CAPEX programs. So there's a hospital that's half built. There may even be money in 2012-13 for the same hospital. Yeah. But the department might feel that there is a chance that it can use all of the 2012-13 money and maybe part of or all of the money that it didn't spend in the previous year. So in other words, it thinks that in 2012-13 it would be able to spend the allocation that it has requested and for which Cabinet is recommending Parliament to appropriate, plus more, and it underspent in the previous year. So it knows already that it underspent in the previous year. And the process of rollover starts early but gets completed around July, August, because they then get approved formally in the adjustment appropriation. Sometimes it is possible to use our judgment, persuade the minister, and say, look, we think that it makes sense that this department will indeed spend this money that's allocated in the new budget, but may actually need more. So unless you give them that certainty, the program might stall, so we recommend that and stuff like that. It's a kind of a judgment call. By the way, by the time we normally get to the adjustment allocation final approval, there is a good sense as to whether they will really spend the money. Sometimes it's not known for a fact. Honorable member asked about the alignment between provincial annual performance plans, I would say even budgets, with national priorities, and whether we check this. And I'm going to make a general comment which is applicable to a number of things that members asked about. I mean, Treasury is only one department, by the way. It's impossible for it to be everywhere and do everything and then still do its own work. I might as well also add that there are different parts of the system that are supposed to play different roles. Given to them by law, in some instances even. The point one is making there is that, yes, Treasury has got a bigger role to play, perhaps, insofar as financial matters are concerned and making sure that the money is used for purposes for which it's intended and so on and so forth. But they are also part of the system. Even if it's executive authorities, even if it's parliament, legislatures, councils that are supposed to play their own roles, use the information that's made available to them, sometimes by the Treasury itself, other times by provincial treasuries, still other times parts of the administration, be it councils and so on. We publish on a quarterly basis the Section 32 report insofar as provinces are concerned, 40 for national government of the PFMA, that is, and 71 insofar as municipalities are concerned. So that's information that you can look at, see that, look, spending is not taking place here. Honorable Singh, you can even see that the spending is taking place, but I know that in Ndoni, the roads are not being built. why is it that the spending is taking place, and you can raise this in one or another form. In our case, as Treasury, as officials, if you bear in mind, we've both got only two politicians in the department. As officials, we don't have, sometimes within the law we can do reasonable things, but we cannot have authority to walk into a municipality or write to a municipality which has got elected representatives and say, we think that you are cheating here and stuff like that. I mean, where do we get that authority? Having said that, I'm not suggesting that there is no role for us. What we do, insofar as concurrent functions are concerned, if you look, for instance, at provincial level, through the Budget Council, we would have meetings where the minister meets his counterparts from provinces. He takes what would have arisen from the cabinet, the Khokha, conversations in the minister's committee on the budget on priorities. If national government thinks that no-fee schools, using this just as an example, are a priority, and therefore more money should be channeled to education, and then the division of revenue takes that into account, allocates a bigger chunk of additional resources to provinces to deal with that issue, then what Treasury would do usually is that once provinces have prepared their budget, we meet them individually, and we look what were their budgets last year, the two-year forward estimates, for an example. Now that they received additional money, how much have they added to their baseline for the programs that national government have given priority to and allocated resources for? And if we see that there is a disjuncture, we raise this with them. Within the limits imposed on this by law, by the Constitution, because we can't quite determine their budget, we can influence them quite strongly, except in instances where there is an intervention of the type you have in Limpopo, there you can then, you know, prepare a budget and almost determine how it should look like, assuming the legislature again would approve it. They can turn it down and kick us back. I'll leave the rest of the questions to my colleagues.
Thanks, DG, for that explanation, and I sympathize with you, because I think you're dealing within a framework that was a compromised position, especially with Chapter 3, Cooperative Governance. I don't know if the Treasury, since the ruling party, has looked at a kind of a developmental state. I sympathize with them, Chair, because to try and manage, because this revenue is raised, I don't know what percentage of revenue is raised at provinces. Maybe it's 0.1% or something. So now we're driving a national agenda with money raised nationally, but provinces can determine how they want to spend it. Now that was done through a compromise, through a negotiation. Now, in where we are currently, do we believe that that can work? I think it must set. And we need, and I don't know if Treasury has actually looked at what we're now speaking about, this developmental state, a strong centre, interventionist, but you also then need to be interventionist. Now, I don't know if we've looked at saying, okay, what are the inhibiting factors to doing it like this, to be able to simply drive programs of government, and what needs to change? Because, I mean, if you were running a corporation the way we have to run, you'd be insolvent, you'd be goners. You can't compete like that, you know. So I personally have got a sympathy and an issue with the way that the kind of governance is structured within the Constitution, and I believe we need to change that, Chair. Thanks.
I'm not sure if this is the right forum for that, but it's fine. PG can respond.
I think when my principals come, they would probably be best placed to answer this part of the question.
Yeah, Chair, I think the one on the Money Bills Amendment Act. Maybe I should just amplify. It's a question of the time frames. You know, Treasury has got a way of presenting the budget and the appropriation bill. Now we've got this act, would say 7 days for this, 8 days for that, 4 days for this. Now, I'm just trying to see, how do you see this thing coming together if we as parliamentarians have to make a meaningful role, play a meaningful role in suggesting amendments? Because there's such time frames over there.
Another thing, that act is our act, is act of parliament. It's not the government, what you call the act. I think that maybe the issue that I think the committee normally raises is that is the political committee, is it called political task team, maybe failing the what you call the committee. I know Honorable Snell likes this, but maybe it's failing because it's not reporting to say, because it's parliament that says we are implementing it, where are we seeing the challenges? For instance, for the first time, the business revenue is passed by NCOP when? In the middle of April. We used to pass it by the 31st of March, but now it's passed now, any time now. I think that it's us who needs to do our own review, whether this, but maybe you're right that in line with National Treasury, how does National Treasury feel about this? Is National Treasury comfortable? Initially, National Treasury was saying, look, we would like it passed by the 31st for the purposes of transfers and all those kinds. But now, what if now it is passed now during April? And it's still a compromise. If we were to stick on those, what we call the time frame that you're talking about, it could go to May before you pass it. Dr. Van Wyk.
Chairperson, thank you. Just before the DG disappeared, I just want to add on or to get clarity on what he said. And I must say, though, in practice, in departments, I came from that arena. You know, it doesn't matter when the bill has been passed. As from the new financial year, in practice, departments carry on with the new budget because it is only technicality that will carry through. After the budget speech in Parliament, it's technicality. It's done. DG, you talk about certain departments carry on and they don't know what they're going to get with the amended budget, and then projects might stop and come to the end of the financial year before the new financial. But I can't agree with you there, because normally, you know, you've got an MTF period. You've got a policy, you've got planning, you've got a budgeting process. Departments know in advance on the MTF period what will be available, what will be appropriate. With the adjusted budget at the end of the year in October, it is only more about unforeseeable and unavoidable that might occur. And if they need money to change between different programs and different items, it can be done by environment. So there's no need for projects and capital expenditure or capital projects and infrastructure to get to an halt. It can carry on. And most of the departments, I assume, are still on the cash basis of accounting, not the accrual basis of accounting. So they can even carry on in March with work that should actually begin in April or May. The payment will just come later. But, of course, then it will be booked for that specific financial year. So neither the amended budget nor the end of the year should be any burden on any department in the execution of their capital functions. You know, they can, the work can carry on. I just want to mention this, and also, you know, the way that it works in departments. It is, once the budget has been done in the beginning of the year, it's an MTF. It's a long, actually, the process has been done before the budget, you know. By the end of the previous year, the whole thing has been done. It is just a book exercise for the minister in February to do the appropriation, you know, and to with his budget speech. And then thereafter, you know, the process on the ground has been executed. All the work has been done. And what we are doing now is actually, we're talking about the budget. The EPCs is about the budget that's already been given to them in the beginning of the year. But now it is the time for the departments to explain to the public out there, this is what we are doing with the money. This is what we are going to plan for next year. Because although you've got a three-year MTF period, every year you have to, you know, to cut here and put, add more there according to the capacity. That is the question I asked in the beginning. Because it might happen that there are certain delays in a certain project, then you won't get money in. Once the third year the first year's collapsed, a new year is coming. But maybe Treasury can say, let's first finish the next 2 years before we allocate for a new third year. You know, so the circumstances will determine that. Thank you.
Well, this maybe I should be a little bit strict now, because the intervention that I had allowed was just for one small thing and allowed whole discussion. Maybe, DG, you can continue.
I am worried that my answer create confusion. I must have lost my touch with explaining things. I was whispering to my colleague, but I'm worried that I can take all the time explaining things that... what I was responding to, Honorable Dr. Van Dijk, was the question of what is the relationship between rollovers and a new appropriation. And I understood Honorable Mashifa to be asking a seriously genuine question as to whether a department that this committee, for instance, is considering an allocation for now, let's say it's got one. 100 million for argument's sake, asking for this year, there may be an allocation next year, 120, let's say 150 over the next 3 years, is justified in asking for a rollover, you know, and what does that rollover do? The point I was making was simply this. One, there is a place for rollovers in our system. It's not an imagination. There is something called a rollover. How does it occur? It occurs when a department in 1 year does not exhaust its resource allocated for a particular, call it program, right? And it, that department thinks that there are good grounds to say that if the allocated amount for the following year, even if it's granted, it might spend more than it and therefore needs the resources that it didn't use in the previous year. And therefore it appeals that, can you give us all or a portion of that money? That's what the rollover is about. Now, it's a judgment call. Would they use the 100 million as an example, plus, say, whatever, 10 that was remaining in the previous year? Or can it be said, live with the 100, 120, and 150 that's allocated, and you will finish the program. In some cases, we do say, we do recommend that against a rollover, because we look at the history of the program and we say, look, there is no reason to give them more money. They've got a history of underspending on this program. There is no point to add more. But in other instances, they produce or present compelling reasons where we feel not granting the rollover could be disruptive, and therefore we recommend that a rollover be granted. That's the point I was making. And it's it explains what happens, why it happens. It's got, and what I've described, the best way I could, is what happened.
Thank you, DG. I think the issue of rollovers is a very important one, but it's not the only issue, and certainly there are many other important issues that have been raised. But just to add to what you're saying, the requirements that we look to impose on requests for rollovers, broadly speaking, want to achieve just one thing, and that's to make sure that the rollover doesn't inflate the budget for the department, that it is a rollover because there is a genuine fiscal liability that the department has committed to, and because of a mismatch between the contracting and the payment of it, that they are not left unfunded. Now, of course, in many things are seldom that clear, and there are a number of grey areas, and that's where we struggle. That's why this is a contentious issue. But the spirit of what we engage in is broadly defined by that, and certainly where there are cases where that principle is not observed, then we are interested in engaging in that and considering
if we have erred or explaining why we have made the decisions that we've made. But I don't want to get distracted by that. I'll run quite quickly through the remaining questions, Chair, and if there are points of clarity, I'm quite happy to come back to them. Dr. Van Wyk, you've asked about the Van Dijk, sorry, excuse me. You asked about the other priorities in this graph. This is a problem with pie charts. They were invented by Florence Nightingale, by the way, a nurse, and a very famous statistician, which is something that is not known about her. And it's her birthday in 2 days' time, which is why, well, it would have been her birthday if she was still around in 2 days' time, which is why I raised it. But, you know, of course, you always have this problem when you aggregate 1 trillion rand and try and break it down into this kind of thing. The slide before it begins to answer some of the questions. What's not included? There are defense allocations. There are public service allocations. There are human settlements allocations that would be included in there. And certainly, if you would like a further breakdown of this graph, we can provide it to you. But it's really just to make the point that in terms of the priorities defined by government for this budget being the competitiveness of the economy, job creation, infrastructure, there are substantial allocations going towards those areas, but the issue of compensation remains a challenge to ensuring that we can give more resources to that, to those priorities. So that's all we're really trying to say here, nothing more than that. A couple of issues raised around capacity and evaluation around infrastructure. Dr. Van Wyk, you asked specifically around the kind of economic capacity, the ability of the economy to support this. You can see from this graph that the 850 billion odd that we're looking at for the next 3 years is not actually a significant amount according to history. We've in fact been at 9.5% of GDP. So it doesn't imply that the public sector build program cannot be met by the broader capacity of the economy, what is especially in an environment where private sector investment is quite low. We would in fact like to see this number being a little bit higher and believe that the broader economy would be able to support that. Of course, if private sector investment was accelerating, we would need to think about whether we need to moderate government's contribution to investment, because something like cement, something like steel is a finite good, and when there are too many people competing for it, you can have inflationary consequences and distribution of resource consequences that don't support long-term development. Honorable Singh, I think what Lungisa said about transfers and within the discussion concurrent functions, I think broadly covers you, but of course it is a difficult area. Part of the problem is contained in its name. It's a transfer. You are reallocating revenue to another entity for them to transact with. It's not a payment. So, you know, the issues of fiscal decentralization, the tensions between wanting to have effective control over how money is spent, but also the benefits of fiscal decentralization are important, and I'm sure that this is an issue that we'll continue to discuss, and you'll discuss with my IGR colleagues for some time to come. The Moneybills Amendment Act has certainly changed the way that we've had to do our business. It's impacted quite substantially on how the budget process is run. We feel the same kind of compression that you guys feel. I'll take the cover of the chair on this issue and not say any more except to simply say that certainly we would be willing to engage with this committee or others on that bill and how it could be developed. The possibility of a parliamentary budget office is, I think, a very exciting and very interesting one for us. I certainly haven't been asked for a contribution from us on this issue, and I would be very happy to. It's the kind of thing that comes up quite regularly in my oversight of fiscal policy and what other countries are doing, where other countries have examined or implemented parliamentary budget offices. Certainly the experience in those countries is quite rich, many successes but also many failures, and if the committee would like some contribution from us on that, we would certainly be happy to provide it. Raquel, do do you want to talk to the National Youth Development Agency while I take a breath?
Okay, I can do that. On the NYDA, the cut to their budget was part of the general cuts that was done to all budgets that Matthew mentioned earlier. So their cuts amounted to $29.1 million in 2012-13, $30.8 million in 2013-14, and $33.4 million in 2014-15. And they mainly affected those cuts on performance bonuses and vacant positions. No.
I'm sorry, Titi. In fact, you know, part of the question, you were not the honorable thing. Yesterday, we were dealing with the report. You would remember that NYDA says to us is receiving $376 million. Now, they stretched this budget to 14 for 2012-2013. Because they will be, they're expecting to recoup 34 million rand from the loans and the other money, I think, from donations. Now the issue is, to us, if we're taking this budget to, one question was how much, if we're going to the House, to Parliament, we say how much Parliament should approve. And then we're saying from fiscus, they're getting 376. The other confusion, we don't understand how to, what you call it, to deal with it. But we know that fiscal space is giving them 376 million. The other money, we're not saying that they should not account or will not monitor the donations that they get. But for the purposes of the budget, we want to confine ourselves to 376. So we really wanted to say we would want assistance from your side as far as this is concerned. Commissioner, you want to add?
And one of the issues around that is because their annual performance plan is based on the 414. Now, you don't know what components of that APP are funded by the money that they're going to raise outside of the fiscus. It doesn't break that down. So if they don't achieve that APP, if they're not achieved it because they haven't collected their 38, so that's where we're a bit stuck.
Yeah, Chair, we are aware of the issue of non-fiscal resources in the National Youth Development Agency. Our public finance team that works with them and with the presidency have scheduled an engagement on it. Broadly speaking, though, I think that this issue is one that you're correct to identify it as a source of concern. Entities are given opportunities to raise their own revenue, take revenue from other sources according to their status, but in doing so they can create substantial service delivery but also fiscal risks should they not be able to realize those dreams, and oversight, proper oversight of that is of course very important and an area that we certainly are looking to strengthen our analysis, but already I think there is considerable work that has been done on strengthening this. The issue of salaries, a very difficult issue for us indeed, and you are correct I think it was also Kaldeblom, Honourable Kaldeblom, who looked at the graph there and noticed the 8.5% growth against the 1%. Salaries are nearly 40% of our non-interest spending. A 1% deviation in what we budget for salaries is very different from a 1% deviation in what we budget for a much smaller program. So 1% of 100 billion rand is very different from 1% in nominal terms to 1% deviation in 1 billion rand. And getting this issue right, getting the right kind of compact between employer and employee is very, very challenging. What we do know from financial management practices, but also from fiscal practice around the world, is that no organization can afford to pay its workers at a rate growing faster than their income. There needs to be a balance between resources available and expenditure in general, and where salaries are such a large part of that, it's a very important and substantial issue and challenge that we face. There is no back pocket for this. There's the contingency reserve, which you're all aware of. It's provided for and disclosed. And if there is an overrun in the compensation budgets, then there is the opportunity for us to utilize the contingency reserve for that purpose. But really, the contingency reserve is there for other purposes, including that. So we don't want to pretend that that is some kind of pressure gauge or pressure valve for this issue. And what you've seen over the last few years, and it's starting to show up very starkly in the numbers, is that where we have substantial overruns in the wage bill, it is putting real pressure on numbers of employees and goods and services budgets and capital budgets. So I think that really... So of the additional resources that we have, the 83 billion rand, salaries are capturing nearly 20 billion rand. And that's why I said, what are we getting for that? We are paying people more, but are we getting more services in exchange for that? If not, then this is just inflationary. It crowds out resources for other forms of spending, plus it adds inflationary pressure, increases the cost of capital, reduces investments in the rest of the economy. So this is a very important challenge that we have, and certainly share with Parliament in the difficulty in finding the right balance, and it's probably not something that we've done sufficiently in the past. The state-owned enterprises, I've spoken to the fiscal risks associated with other entities. There's the problem of the decentralization of giving these agencies the right corporate form to pursue their business as effectively as possible, but certainly the oversight, the monitoring of it is very important. Our assets and liabilities management unit does a lot more work in terms of this. There's also the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation that is involved, and as the fiscal risks involved here have increased, we've certainly been paying much more attention to this, and something that will continue to drive our work for some time to come. Honourable Helderblom, the debt service cost numbers are non-discretionary. We've got no choice over that. When you decide to run a deficit of X billion rand, there is you get charged interest on that number, and you must go into that contract knowing the difficult consequences of that. Certainly, it has started to take away resources from other forms of spending. If you have a look at Chapter 3, you'll see in the fiscal framework that debt service costs as a percent of GDP have gone up from around 2.2% to around, I think looking at them going to 2.7% of GDP. So these are claiming a higher, and if you look at them as a share of spending, you will see a similarly aggressive trend that non-interest spending is not growing as fast as total spending, and that's because debt service costs are growing so fast. But when you enter into deficits like we have, and they were important because our revenue was under pressure, we believe that to have been a temporary event, and we believe that we can manage and control that event over the medium term, this is the unfortunate consequence, and it's the main reason, in fact, why we want to see a moderation of the deficit over a reasonable period of time, because we don't want to be found ourselves in a situation where austerity is being forced on us because that debt service cost number has become unsustainable. That is the worst possible outcome for any government. The social and economic consequences really are catastrophic, as we're beginning to see around the world. I think that Lungisa touched on most of the other issues. I just want to talk to infrastructure planning and reporting again very briefly. I think that certainly planning for infrastructure projects and the reporting on how they are implemented is an area where, which if we look at the reasons why infrastructure or capital budgets have not performed the way we expected, this is an issue that comes up from time to time. I think the Presidential Infrastructure Commission is a useful innovation in that regard, and it's certainly one of an important innovation in resolving it, but certainly from our side, playing a much more direct role in managing and regulating the planning space so that we know when projects come to us for allocation that the planning work has taken place, that the transactions will flow according to the sequence that is outlined, and then it will buy the kinds of services that are proposed in the business case, I think is a very important part of developing our work going forward. I'll leave it at that, Chair.
No, I think everything has been covered.
Yeah, Chair, just on the slide that gives you the pie chart, the health component, does the NHI, the 150 million run, I think, for NHI, is that included in that? Included in that, or is it being treated separately under other expenditure, other priorities? It's other priorities. And I wonder, Chief, about the NHI, if you can just give us some forward thinking on NHI. I mean, it's something that we're all supporting. But and then your Section 100 interventions, how are they going? I mean, in those provinces that where you've intervened? Thanks.
the budget makes provision for the piloting of NHI. In fact, the districts the 10 districts that Minister Motsoaledi had referred to, I think they have been identified now. And the aim is to see then what is the kind of package of health services that should comprise the sort of health insurance and what they cost, so that could assist the sort of modeling going forward, in addition to the one that has been done as a basis for the broader policy. The green paper, as you would know, Mr. Simmons, was published. The idea would be that in about 3-4 years' time, then the phasing begins. And of course, will take anything between 10 to 15 years to actually implement over time. That's the stream insofar as that the broader NHI is concerned. For its part, the Treasury is charged with looking at the financing models, looking at the, and the Minister had mentioned this in his speech, I think it was contained in the budget review, looking at the different tax instruments that could be used to raise additional revenue to meet the gap in the current levels of funding projected forward versus the actual financing requirement for full implement for the phased implementation of NHI. And the specific instruments that we're looking at are mentioned in the budget review, with an indication that there is no preference of one over others. And it might even be that the ultimate resource will come from some combination of 2 or 3, or it could even be more instruments to the extent that they could be. The interventions in provinces have gone fairly well, success somewhat mixed, though. The one province that had reached what one could describe as a kind of crisis point was Limpopo, because without assistance from national government, there was a possibility, but this is history now. I mean, I know that it gets recorded as if it's fresh again. There was a risk that they could have ground to a halt and not been able to pay salaries, but that's history. What the intervention has been able to certainly produce is some stabilization of the financial situation of the province. the overdrafts have been reduced. The province is able to meet its financial obligations. You would have heard in the beginning that there were some glitches in so far as, for instance, payment of suppliers is concerned. One would say that to a certain degree, perhaps exaggerated in certain extents, because it suited people to do that. But that too is gone. I mean, you can be the judge because you don't see it in the media. But does that mean that the province is now okay and can function on its own? Not really. It's still a long way to go, or perhaps I should say some way to go, because if you just take, for an example, the department where we are closely involved, which is the Treasury, it has tabled what we consider to be a reasonable budget, provides for dealing with the accumulated debts from the past, for an example. That's why I say it's a reasonably good budget in that regard. But the province does not have its own people yet in the critical positions now. I mean, the person who's playing the role of head of treasury comes from central government. The person who's playing the role of heading cash management is not from the province. So the next phase is going to be to identify the critical pillars of each one of these departments. If it's public works, for instance, property management, contract management is going to be important. We must help the province find the right people in those jobs. And then on over the long term, and this is going to be a political judgment call, among other things, phase down then our involvement, given the history of what we've been doing. Gauteng had been a difficult one, because the intervention in Gauteng was not quite... does that mean there's fire somewhere?
It's the house.
Oh. Yeah, so the in Gauteng it was held, and it's still mixed, because they owed lots of money to people, but they had the cash in the bank. In some cases there were disputes, if you take National Health Laboratory Services and stuff like that. But KZN too, by the way, owed National Health Laboratory Services, and there were disputes between them, processes set in motion. Free State, Section 101A, particularly in Treasury and the Roads Department, there is progress there. The situation is not quite where it ought to be for us to even reconsider, the intervention. But at least there is definitely, I cannot see, at least on the horizon, any crisis again, so far as those provinces are concerned. But the difficulty, especially in relation to Gauteng, is that the province is still running its own business. We're just there to support them. So we don't know on a daily basis what's happening there.
I think it was omitted. And then, in fact, we had the other day quarter on third quarter, and then when we were asking about their performance, about the performance of that committee work, we found that we said to them they must provide us with a full response, but it looked like they are spending more on the on administration than on really employing people on the ground. But I think they had promised us to give us a full response. We have not yet received that response. So the question is, I know, Treasurer, that in most clusters you have people around the clusters, but the monitoring of this, it looks like they slip through the cracks, you know. As I said earlier, we see this money is just being shifted, easily shifted elsewhere.
Yes, I mean, look, it's not something that I've got information on, by the way. I don't think, though, the description of easily shifting is the perfect one. I mean, certainly the understanding, I know, has occurred. The fact that for some of the programs, the costs of doing the stuff as opposed to the payment in salaries or wages to people who are supposed to benefit, are a matter of concern. One of the ways to remedy that could be to sort of set thresholds and say for every rand spent on a program like this, X or only X cents can go to admin, nothing more, something like that. We do check, at least from a systems point of view, whether CWP, Community Works Program, or EPWP money is spent against EPWP in terms of the coding on the system. But, I mean, checking on the ground if there are people actually employed, staff, it's a bit too much for us. But I would say that it's laudable that your committee is asking the department that. That's actually, you are owed such explanation, such report. I think that it would be in order, actually, for you to insist on regular reports, whether regularity means quarterly or at least after the first quarter, monthly, because people can give you, they should give you that. I would say that falls within your role. Now, government also has the monitoring and evaluation unit. I mean, it's taken time to really build it, get it to be where it is. But
members, do I take that we have exhausted the questions? Well, DG, I would like to, maybe before I come to that, I don't know if you have any closing remarks. Well, I would like to take this opportunity to thank you. You know, the engagement is not a once-off thing, but I think that as a committee for now, we're satisfied with the submission. If there are other questions that in engaging amongst ourselves, we find that we have not perhaps raised or we still need clarity, I'm sure it will still be in order for, well, another question that was not raised, was not responded, or this question of the administration, the budget of the administration vis-a-vis the budget of what one could take as core responsibility of the Vatican. The question was, is there uniformity, or do you intend regulating the Vatican
Chair, there's no uniformity in terms of, if I understand you correctly, in terms of regulating the size of administrative budgets for certain types of government.
I'm sorry, the issue is the items that need to go into administration vis-a-vis the item that's correct. Yes.
The structuring of budgets, we have been quite strict in working with our colleagues to try and make sure that what's in administration, more or less, when you compare it across sectors, is the same. in terms of the sizes, they vary. I mean, it's also a function of the nature of department. Some departments would have, just if you think about it, they would have large corporate services divisions by virtue of the nature of their business. Others, that function would be small relative to the other activities that they do. So as a percentage of the total budget of a department, administration would tend to be would tend to be small. I think Rachel may even have a more elegant answer to this than what I'm giving you. But we are aware that administration is an area that can be open to abuse. That is why when we talk about shifting composition of expenditure, reallocating, reprioritizing, it tends to be the first target. Was it 2 years or whatever ago, we cut it by the 2.5, some sort of flat percentage across all departments without checking what is in it. By the way, what's interesting, which shows the differences, is that for a department like SAPS, when you cut there, they would complain because some of what is core to their business is embedded in that function. So that's the why.
Perhaps I can just add that the Treasury did issue budget structure guidelines in an attempt to standardize what is in those administration programs.
If we could have a copy of that. Because I think that for us, DG, like you concede as well that people would put in items that are not supposed to be there. The budget, the classification, for instance, of the budget is saying economic classification. It speaks about current matters, compensation of employees and capital. And you find that the issue that you thought that they were supposed to go to capital, you find them there in the administration. If you like, one day we can give you, can pick up examples of that. Yeah, because we would like to see some kind of a guideline, you know, in terms of what is it that you expect to be in administration. We agree that it will not be the same departments that have got different functions, but we just agree with that. But, I hope that we will be having some departments that we have invited for appropriation. I'm not sure about the program and the dates. They are not in front of me. But I think that we normally make our program available to National Treasury. And sometimes we would like your support. For instance, I know that, our headquarter report is not ready, but we have issues with some departments like water affairs. For instance, but you'll get what you call a report. On that note, on behalf of the committee, I'd like to thank you very much. Sure. Honourable members, I think that
we're done. And the there's no meeting tomorrow morning. We're meeting on Tuesday. And what are the... For what? Is that the 15th? Yes. What? On Tuesday, we're meeting the Public Service Commission. What time? The meeting on Tuesday is at 10, another member.
Okay.
If we could try to be there at 10, so that we don't make these people to wait.
You don't
have
a
Wat? Ik heb de vraag. Ik heb de vraag. En dat is voorzitter. Dates, have they been finalized for the oversight? Because we need to make some other bookings as well. So we just need
for the oversight, or are you talking about the study tour?
Oh, what do you call it? Study tour, sorry. I use oversight because I confused my caucus.
No, you're right.
The oversight.
No, oversight, but now we have finalized those dates.
No.
But all that we're waiting for now is a program from them. They have confirmed, we've got an email yesterday. We got an email that confirmed that they would have received. So all that is left is out there, the program. Oh, I'm sorry, you said you would need a passport number. Maybe rather